Good morning, Tucson, and welcome to the Morning Voice this Tuesday, the Engagement Hours. Still getting used to saying hours on the back. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time.
Good morning.
There's a whole lot of enthusiasm coming from behind that glass, despite the fact we had very little sleep. But we'll get back. We'll get to that in a minute. The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, five different hosts, five different topic areas, as well as five different perspectives. We appreciate you joining us every morning from 7 to 9, either during your drive time or your morning coffee. You can join us both on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station, or you can be with us on our Facebook Live.
We're on YouTube, and I will put a link over on Facebook so people can jump over to YouTube if they'd like to watch. So give me a couple of minutes. I'll get that on there.
There you go.
Yeah,
we've got two of them going. So I appreciate the enthusiasm back there, Matt. We need it.
We need coffee, buddy. That we do.
For those of you who are not baseball fans, the World Series Game 3, the first one in Dodger Stadium last night, went a little late into the evening.
Just a tad.
I think, Matt, you tapped out after the
14th. I gave up after 14.
I made it to 16.
I may have made it 15. I can't tell, but yeah.
It all blurs.
Yeah.
I did make it to 16, and I just couldn't do it anymore. Set a World Series record for the most innings in a single game.
Right.
It went 18, and that's when Freddie Freeman won it for the Los Angeles Dodgers with a home run, for those of you who may not have seen that.
Well, you know, L.A. sports fans, having lived there and been a part of the scene, man, but you know how it works. You know, they all leave at the sixth inning, so they'd left. Some of them had left three times by the time the game was over.
No kidding. And the amazing thing about it, I mean, there was a lot of conversation about how the air gets thick up there at the top of the little hill that the Dodger Stadium sits on, and that the ball doesn't travel as far, and seemed like everybody's swinging for the fences on both sides trying to finish this game with one hit.
It gets a little heavy, yeah.
But the amazing thing to me was the pitcher that came in for the Dodgers had nobody left in their dugout. In their bullpen,
right.
None.
Yeah.
It was like the last man. How would you like to be the guy sitting down there going, okay, everybody's pitched except me. What's going to happen next? Will Klein went in, and he pitched through 72 pitches, four innings. It was more than he'd pitched in all season combined, is what I heard. Wow. I have not verified that one. But he, big old red beard.
Yeah.
The two innings I saw, he was just loving it. He ended up with five strikeouts over those four innings. And here's a guy who, even the announcers go, what happens if he has trouble?
Or
you've
seen long games like that. They'll throw third baseman in. I mean, at some point, it does happen.
But those games are normally when it's like 18-2.
And there's nothing on the line. World Series.
Your last pitcher is now on the mound. And he had an incredible run. And, I mean, he wasn't on the World Series roster when the World Series started.
Yeah.
He came in for one of their pitchers who had a family emergency and needed, so he got a special exemption to add somebody to the roster.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was literally the last man standing for that and went four innings.
Well, I've seen some headlines that the guy, it was just like, the guy was like, it was pure joy, you know?
And
why not? The guy's playing with house money at this point. I mean, what's he got to lose? Yeah. So just go out there and let it rip and have fun, and good for him.
Absolutely. And as Dodger fans will say, let's go blue. So it's 2-1. Speaking of blue.
Nice segue.
You like that transition?
Yes.
There was an article in the Tucson Agenda written by Joe Ferguson and Kurt Pendergrass called Project Blue, an Incomplete History.
Sure.
You know, this is a story that will never die. I guess we're going to be able to use this for a while. But what I found interesting about this is they did a records request, and they got 217 pages of documentation.
They tended to bandy about, look at us, we got 470, you know, but they did get some gems.
They did.
Yeah.
I think everybody, all of our listeners are probably aware, Project Blue is the big data center discussion that the city of Tucson was supposed to annex. One of the things that they did find is there was conversations at the county level that all the locations that were viable probably in order to have water supply were going to need to be annexed by the city.
Yeah.
So the whole key to a lot of this initially, the belief was you had to get the city to annex it or there wouldn't be any data centers.
But you said there were conversations at the county level, and there were also conversations where?
at the city level.
Yes, at the city level.
Yeah.
The mayor who claimed, oh, I'm shocked to find out that there's conversations on data centers going on. And it's like, oh, the notes from your 2022 meet or your 2022 meeting about data centers, Madam Mayor.
Yeah, it was, it's an interesting article. You know, we don't often push other places to go find some source, but I think if you want to get some of the background on it, it points out very clearly that as early as March 2023, there was a meeting with Mayor and Mike Ortega.
Yeah, so she basically lied.
Coming on. It's
And I'd heard this back channel from somebody who would know. I had heard this back channel. And there was, you know, you saw the mayor at the televised council meeting, and she's not the public hearing that we've already hashed that one to death, but at the council meeting, I'm shocked that conversations were going on between city officials. Really, were you?
Well, that's the thing that's can be troubling at first. I didn't necessarily hear her say I knew nothing about it per se, but she definitely put some blame on to the city council.
Right.
I mean, to Barbara Coffey, who's now moved on.
Who's now no longer working there.
The rumor on in the economic development, the business organizations with Barbara Coffey was looking. She was going to go. It had gotten too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that brings up the whole discussion on how many economic development organizations or entities do you need if you're working on a project? Now, obviously, this one was going to be multi-district. But it does a great job, and I'll give both of them credit, for kind of dissecting it. And the fact of the matter is it brings up a point. Remember, who was our guest last week? Colleen Sanchez,
yes,
from IBM. Big deep dive discussion about AI, about some of the capacities. And she talked about one idea of an AI program that would be out there that would take more energy than
we've got. A huge sliver of our energy portfolio to do one data run on it.
But the fact of the matter is, without these data centers, you looked at what happened to the Amazon Web Services last week.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
We would have that more and more again. The reliance upon the internet, the reliance upon data.
Yeah.
Whether it's the use of our phones, whether it's the jobs we do all day, we have to have this discussion, and we have to figure out how to do it. And people are now shocked that they found paper, you know, some of the documentation they found, talked about it in the city of Tucson, talked about it in Marana, talked about it in Pima County, and then the needs that they're going to have. And the interesting thing is it hasn't slowed down. The big argument during Project Blue was what? What was the
water and electricity use.
Water. And it was way more heavy on the water.
Sure.
They were banging the water home, even though the investment was going to be that purple pipeline, which would allow us to make better use of our reclaimed water.
Yeah,
better use, because people still aren't comfortable with reclaimed water coming to the tap.
But here's the question that I'm guessing that this article does not answer. There's a belief out there that the original position for Beal infrastructure was a closed loop system, okay, that would run water through cooling towers and not use all the water, and that the city insisted on going with. That the city said, no, we want to run we want to expand our reclaimed water infrastructure. So if you will do this $100 million, you know, investment and run the 17-mile pipeline out there.
18, don't forget, 18.
I'm sorry?
18.
18 miles?
18 miles of purple pipe.
A purple pipe. If you'll run this out there, you know, we'll give you access to Tucson water resources. We will give you access to the water.
And were going to put in 3 aquifer reach, or 30 acres of that land was going to be made into an aquifer recharge facility to put the water back in the ground.
Great.
So there's a lot of investment in water.
Right. But, and everybody's thinking, $100 million. Well, for Beal Infrastructure or Amazon or whoever's writing the check, that was a fraction. That was like, you know, maybe a
drop in the bucket
of the total investment in the project. My point is that the city was, I mean, all this anger at Amazon or Beal that was going to use a design that was going to use all this water, that really should be, if in fact it's true, I'll preface it, if in fact the city was the one that says, no, don't do the closed loop one, do this one because you're going to be helping us with, then that anger is really rightfully aimed at the city.
And that is, you said that's the million dollar, I guess in this case, the $100 million
question.
Yeah, so
the 417 pages of data trove didn't get to the answer on that one. But the other one, because BL Infrastructure or somebody said it in one of their memos to Jan, that there, our initial position was to do like the one in Pinal County that Vermaland is doing.
Right.
It was going to be a closed loop system. And the other thing I just want to point out is Joe Ferguson and Kurt Prendergast in the, they said companies put up big dollars to win a piece of the $1 trillion AI pie. While local residents worry about straining the power grid, which leads to costly electric bills and threats to water supplies. So they just throw that matzo ball out there and just with no backing, right? Well, the threat to the water supply is if you don't use a closed loop system, which is apparently a technology solution that is available that the city of Tucson allegedly, right, did not want. And I'm sorry, if you, nuclear power is very cheap, okay? If you could get a modular nuclear system or, you know, the fact of the matter is the data center was going to pay its pay for its electricity. How is that driving costs up for everybody else?
And it's not going to drive the electric costs. Now, I understand the electric use, but you just hit one of the key answers. Right. People are so fearful of nuclear. I was talking with somebody the other day, and we were talking about if Three Mile Island had never happened, imagine how far and the proliferation we'd have of nuclear systems now, and they are safe. If you look at the number of nuclear electric sources throughout the world, they're safe and they're green.
Mm-hmm.
They're some of the cleanest energy.
Mm-hmm.
Palo Verde, you look at what it does. California may outlaw nuclear electricity in their country, in their state, but they're importing ours.
Of course, PG&E was a part owner of the facility. So I guess my point is the reporters had to throw that line out there really without any justification. They just present that as fact.
Yeah.
And it's just that kind of reporting really gets me.
I know you don't like that. So I guess our request to Joe Ferguson and Kurt Prendergast, again, I really like this article.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot of good information. I learned much about the trail. Find out that question.
Yeah.
Find out now, did the city know that there was a closed loop system and that the water wasn't the issue, that was something they asked about? Because it highlighted it. And as soon as now you've seen that whole argument gone, they're not talking about the electricity or the water anymore.
That's right.
Now they're talking about the electricity. But the reality is, as Colleen said last week, these are going to happen. They're either going to happen in our country, they're going to happen somewhere. And if people say, well, if they don't happen in our country, we can still access it. Well, it's not as effective. Well, it's not as efficient, and it's got a lot of issues. But
and it's still going to happen.
Get ready, it's coming.
It's still going to happen at the fairgrounds.
Oh yeah,
you know that they're full speed ahead, and now they're unencumbered with what has been. You know, they are unencumbered with the city. They don't have to do anything for the city now.
Oh yeah, no, there's no doubt. They made it very clear. There are multiple sites still in Pima County, they're going up, and the site you talked about in Finales, 3,000 acres. It's incredible. Now, will we? This all get built out? Probably not, but something will. So, I know our guest is waiting for us to let him in the front door.
Okay.
We'll be back after this break with Mike Ortega, the executive director for the Pima Association of Governments and the Regional Transportation Authority. Stay with us on 10:30 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely, thank you for that opening morning conversation and the spike of energy to pick us up here. Now we need some hot coffee and we will be rolling.
I'm on it.
Ah, that's so good. Nothing like pouring a cup of coffee in the morning and finding out it's cold.
Morning, Michael. So, you got any questions for Mr. Ortega?
Yeah, you mean I'm going to interview Mike Ortega, the executive director of the Pima Association of Governments and the Regional Transportation Authority. There, I know where you're going. he won't deny or confirm a meeting in March of 2023. But
did they want a closed loop system? Now, let's start with that one. Did they want a closed loop system, and the city talked him out of it?
All I can say is I don't recall that conversation, to be honest with you, at that time.
Yeah, I know you were. It's funny how timing is everything in this life, and I think you might have gotten the move out of the city was perfectly timed to avoid the I guess what we'll call the data center debacle and all that went down with it. But that's not why we're having you here today. The Morning Voice on Tuesdays when I host is about engagement, trying to get people encouraged to get them involved in their communities and their nation. We are a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality, and with that comes some rights and responsibilities. And for some, that includes service to our country and others to the community. And there is no doubt that our next guest, Michael Ortega, has been incredibly involved in service to his communities. Mr. Ortega is originally from Douglas, Arizona, earned a bachelor's degree in civil engineering and received his master's in business administration, both from the University of Arizona. He's also completed the executive management program in state and local government at the University of Harvard, John F. Kennedy School of Government. And before he joined the city of Tucson, which obviously was the job he had right before he was asked to come in and take over PAG RTA, he served as a county administrator for Cochise County and the city manager for the city of Douglas. I mean, that's, to me, computed. It was a job. It was employment. It was a passion. But it's service, because everything that I just listed that you've done has always been to try to make the communities you were in, the community you grew up in, and I know you're passionate about where you grew up and your family, a better place to be. And I think you did that for nearly 30 plus years, and then you finally retire, and then you've got all these elected officials knocking at your door saying, hey, we'd like you to throw your name in the hat for this job. What were you thinking when you did that?
Well, I was actually in my shop when I got a phone call, and I had to turn my machines off. And, you know, I'm a woodworker, and I enjoy doing that. You know, I think it's an opportunity. And certainly when you have challenges in a community that's struggling, whatever that looks like, and you think you can bring the skill sets to help, I think that's it's really the role. And I've been very blessed to have the opportunity. And, you know, you didn't mention when I was up at ADOT, you know, I was doing the state engineer.
That's right. I forgot the state engineering one. How could somebody sitting on the ADOT board forget that you at one time were the state engineer? Not while I was on the board, but you were.
Right. And it was a very similar conversation when the governor's office called me and said, hey, could you help us with a few things? So I think it's just an opportunity to use the gifts that I've been given and you know, try to make the community a better place.
Well, I think there's no doubt you've made a difference in those communities. We've talked about RTA a lot. You've been on multiple radio shows talking about the RTA Next, what the role is, what the plan's going to look like, what the process, and we'll get to that. But first, I want to just have you kind of talk about what it is that the Pima Association of Governments does. People forget that those are dual slots, and in your current position, you're the executive director of both of those organizations.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. So the Pima Association of Governments is actually a nonprofit. It's not a government. It's a 501c4, and the charge basically is to act as a convener of the region's governments. And so we have all of the members, which are all of the agencies, all of the jurisdictional partners within the region. And the idea is that it's identified as the clearinghouse, if you will, for a lot of state and federal transportation money. I mean, that's the reason that it was founded many, many, many years ago. So when you look at that becomes, you know, I just heard it referred to as Switzerland, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody can kind of come in, have a conversation, and craft out what the region's priorities are, and then move it forward. But over time, there's also opportunity. They do dabble. We have dabbled in environmental. We've got a whole team of modelers that model population trends, transportation trends, variety of those, we'll call them regional issues, but all we do is provide the data. We basically interpret information, provide that to the jurisdictional partners, and gives them an opportunity to really look at, you know, how these data sets will ultimately help the region as a whole.
And as a metropolitan planning organization, there is a lot of plans that come out of it, long-range plans. And you mentioned transportation. A lot of this focus is around transportation, but it also includes things like water quality, air quality, and it's kind of expanded. I mean, and there's a whole list of it.
That's correct.
What do you see as the challenges of keeping, one, those plans current, but also getting the elected officials to come to agreements on the importance of what should and shouldn't be in issues like water quality and air quality?
So that's really the bottom line is, again, the purity of the data, making sure that the data is available, making sure that the methods are sound on how we generate that data, but then also present it in a way that here's the information, take it as you will. However, this helps to craft policy decisions and policy direction going forward. And I think the commonality is water, air, those are all regional issues. There's not a boundary, if you will. And so that becomes commonality. That becomes the opportunity to have conversations beyond just a singular issue in a community.
In your role as the city manager of Tucson, you actually chaired some of those committees that go about it. What do you see now in your new role as your biggest challenge to get the elected officials to agree?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's looking for commonality. It's looking for commonality, but you used a word right at the beginning, engagement. It's making sure everybody's engaged.
Well, there's no doubt you've been doing that. You've been doing it on behalf of RTA Next a lot, but it's going to be a role hopefully you'll have for a while, and you'll continue to push. When we get back from this break, I'd like to dive into RTA Next and how that plan and process looks and what the steps it's going to go through.
Sounds great.
All right, please stay with us after the bottom of the hour break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Voice. It's 7:34 on Tuesday, October 28th. Hope your drive time, if you're on the road, is going smooth. I haven't seen too much red yet on our traffic charts.
Not too bad, yep.
But we'll keep that going. Our guest this morning with us is Michael Ortega, the Executive Director of the Pima Association of Governments and the Regional Transportation Authority. So RTA Next is in a kind of a unique position right now, Mike, because it's been forwarded to the ballot, and it will be on the ballot for March 10th. But we still have City Tucson elections going. Part of your job at RTA is to basically educate the population. So how is that going, and what direction is that taking?
So it's going well. I mean, there's a lot of work to do between now and March. Ballots drop February 11th. You know, that's when the mail ballots actually go out to the voters. And so really it's all hands on deck to make sure that we are educating folks as best we can. Our goal when we started back in August really was to get to about 200 different organizations. We're all on our way to that now. We've got a variety of well, we'll call it organizations, but presentations scheduled. I mean, you know some of those. But clearly, when we're asked to go out and speak to a group, we try to make sure that they're well-educated and understand not only the process that we went through to generate the plan, but also the importance. And I think that it's a regionally important plan that you know, the voters are going to have the opportunity to consider in March.
So what is the connectivity that of RTA Next, and how will it help the citizens? What's in this plan ultimately?
So oftentimes we think of transportation, right, as singular, a vehicle, you know, getting from point A to point B, you know, how you physically drive to work, you know, or you're actually getting your vehicle. What I think we need to look at is take a little bit of a step back, and there is entirely a mobility system that we have to think about. And the mobility system is all aspects of how we transport goods, services, and people. And that's not just a matter of you driving. Certainly that's important, but it's also an opportunity to think about it, non-motorized vehicle, bike, ped, how we transport folks. Transit, another one, obviously. But all of them use some type of a system, some type of infrastructure. Well, that can't happen if you don't invest in it. And I think as you start looking at the importance of that mobility system as a whole, you realize that there's a need for dollars. There's a need for funding for that.
And what impact will the RTA Next have on those dollars that we have available?
Well, there's two components to that question, I think, Ted. One is there's no tax increase with the RTA Next. So basically what we currently pay a half-cent sales tax for transportation or for this mobility system. That will continue. All we're basically asking is for the voter to consider continuing that for another 20 years. So oftentimes when you think about a tax and people talk about a tax, they think about it as, well, I'd like the status quo. You know, I don't want a new tax. I don't want another tax. Understandable. However, think about this. The status quo today is the tax exists, and the tax, all we're asking for is it to continue into the future. But when you take it in the perspective of overall dollars that come to the region, we currently get about $50 to $54 million a year from the state and from the federal government for transportation purposes. Our own tax, if RTA Next is to continue, will generate about $125 to $126 million a year. So you can see 60% plus of that funding would be local. It's locally generated, locally driven, local decisions, all of the local opportunities for improvement in that system.
You've got experience as the Arizona Department of Transportation engineer, state engineer. Can you talk about what role having an authorized regional transportation authority or funding plays into getting projects on the five-year plan? I think a lot of folks aren't aware, but five-year plan is really a one-year plan because the State Transportation Board approves it every year. But there is some advantage, as I understand it, to having those funds and the authority to get your projects on that plan.
Well, if you think of it, it's very very much like a leverage. You're leveraging local dollars to get bigger, better, more money from the federal government or from the state government. And in this particular instance, your example is the state government. And so by showing that the local region, if you will, wants to invest in itself, it gives opportunity for additional dollars to come into the region. That becomes extremely important because we're able to then use the dollars that are out there, if you will, for improvements and priorities here in Pima County. And so some of the projects rely heavily on the state or federal government in terms of dollars that come to the region or could come to the region if there's the local dollars that we'll call them as a match.
So will the voters have the opportunity to see what percentage of the funds come from their half cent, but also what percentage they're getting from those federal or those state funds?
Yeah, so if you go to the RTA Next, let's see, rtanext.com, I believe that's, or rtanextmobility.com, and you do a search there, you can find the actual project list. And the project list shows the individual projects within the plan, also has the amount of money that's going to come from RTA Next, you know, from the sales tax. But it also has another column, and you can see where those dollars are leveraged, and you can see the amount. And in some instances, it's actually greater than the investment by the local dollars. So in a few of the instances, you know, the local dollars are actually a small part or fraction of the overall cost.
RTAmobility.com is where you'd start, and then there's an RTA Next tab, and it will take to you, and it goes through a much longer name, which we don't want to repeat on that one. So before we take our next break, and we've got about 4 or 5 minutes, so it's not a rush, can you kind of just talk through what's in the plan and what you think it's important for the voters to be aware of in the education part of this so they know what they're going to face?
Sure. So I think for those who remember 20 years ago, or for those who have been watching this, the plan is very similar to what was approved by the voters in 2006. So the existing plan that we're in today was from 2006 to 2026. And so it's getting ready to expire. And so that's the reason for us to go out and have a conversation with voters. So the chemistry of that plan is very similar. It's a very, very similar plan, with one exception, which is the arterial and collector road pavement rehabilitation. That component of it really is a function of hearing from the people, hearing from the public, the importance of pavement rehabilitation. So people, you know, will give us feedback and say, look, this is great, we think the program is wonderful, but we've got potholes, you know, help us with that, right? So what we did is we actually went and challenged the statute and looked at it and said, okay, how can we use regional dollars for that? And we found that we could use it for pavement rehabilitation. That's not filling potholes, but certainly we can go into some of the arterials and collector roads, the main arteries within the region, and reconstruct that pavement, you know, in its entirety. Now the key there is it's got to have, we're not going to go out there and patch a pothole that'll last maybe here or thereabouts, but we're actually going to go in and design that pavement so that it'll last 10 years plus. And that's a key component. So some of the other pieces, obviously roadways, and you know, similar to what we had in the 06, safety, ADA, and active transportation. Active transportation is, I'll call it a fancy way of saying pedestrian and vehicle, and bicycles. And so it's non-motorized mobility. Also have an environmental component to it, wildlife linkages. The other thing we found is the public was very concerned about animal hits, not just to protect the animals, but obviously to protect themselves and their kids, the people that are driving late at night. Those are our concerns. So there's some money in the plan for that. And then transit. About 27% of the overall plan is investment in transit.
And I think one of the things that people found interesting in the discussion on the transit piece in it, there was a lot more clamoring or desire from some of the outside the city of Tucson regions for investment in transit, particularly Oro Valley. I know they were very concerned about that.
When we think of transit, we think of the fixed route. We think of the bus stop. We think of the buses that, that traverse the city.
They're definitely the thing that gets attention. That's
absolutely,
for sure.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, people don't know or don't realize that transit is a much bigger system than that. And when we talk about transit, it's also the paratransit and Dial-A-Ride. And those are services that are provided to the region as a whole. But those that are on the outlying areas, particularly, as you mentioned, Oro Valley, not that Oro Valley is on the outlying area, but they are not in the urban core, if you will. And so they rely very heavily on the Dial-A-Ride and the paratransit for their services.
So that's, I think that's something that people do miss. I know Oro Valley's, you're thinking about it, still a large percentage of the pot for a small percentage of the population that uses it. But it is important to be part of that regional transportation system. On the environmental wildlife linkages, some people see that, and it's a relatively small pot of money when you look in the 20-year plan. But talking to the folks who are passionate about that, believe that we'll be able to use that money to leverage federal and or private grants even. I mean, there's organizations out there that aren't connected to the government that have money that are for donations that can also then be captured to enhance that. And again, it's not just for the safety purpose, but for some, it's also for the ability for the wildlife to roam where they need to go.
That's correct. And it's not just about a specific facility, we'll say, where wildlife linkage is a bridge or something like that. It's actually the mindset to recognize that these corridors, these wildlife corridors, are important to the region. And so, for example, oversizing culverts is a big part of that. Well, there's an opportunity to keep that in our design criteria going forward.
And part of that big play is that design, because it may increase some costs. You can use some of that cost to offset some of the road projects. There's a lot of different ways you can do it once you get there. There's no doubt about that. When we come back after this break, what I'd like to hit is some of the big items that are in there, some of the roadway projects that are going to truly help people get to where they want to go. Talk a little bit about the leverage of some of those projects, particularly the ones that the state participates in, and then really lay out the plan that you have for RTA to educate the community without advocating as we go into election season.
Sounds great.
All right, Michael, appreciate it. That's Mike Ortega, the executive director of the Pima Association of Governments and the Regional Transportation Authority, and we'll be right back after the break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Welcome back. All right. I always love when I hear some Tom Petty going through the radio and through my headset. So thanks, Matt Neely, for that one. I may have spoken a little too early as we had a little bit more traffic that time when we came around. So I, you know, there we go. I'm talking about the great traffic. But that leads into our conversation now. So Michael Ortega, the executive director of the Regional Transportation Authority and Pima Association of Governments, we've talked about some of the other things that aren't roadway related that are advantageous to us. We've just talked about some of the traffic backups. Huge project right now going on I-10 to expand it from two lanes each direction to three lanes farther down all the way to Country Club. What else is in this plan as far as roadway construction that's going to help people get from east to west, north to south, and also when they need to leave the Tucson area on the freeways and going?
So, Ted, why don't I start on the east side? We'll start over on we'll go as far as Colossal Cave Road and then start moving our way back, and then we can maybe ask me questions on some of the urban core. But when you look at again, the region as a whole, the needs are many. The needs are spread across the entirety of the area. And so when you start looking at the demand and the types of improvements, we have a project at Colosso Cave Road from I-10 to Camino Loma Alta. And that's almost $175 million project. And that you've got the railroad crossing there. You got some of the challenges there. I mean, people that live out that way know that very clearly. You know, Marion Cleveland Way is also on the plan as well, from Houghton to Colosso Cave. You know, that's to widen it to a 4-lane road. You know, help through that. Again, Houghton Road was part of RTA 1. So this is a continuation of those improvements in that southeast quadrant of the community.
And I believe Marianne Cleveland Way originally was just going to go to the border of the city of Tucson and the county, but as one of the last changes before it was voted, it was to extend it all the way, which may only make sense. Take it all the way to where it connects to Colosso Cave versus having it go from 4 to 2 and then back to 4.
Another great example of cooperation, right? So that was a city and county working together and saying, hey, you know what? This might make sense. So let's look at it. And so they started working together and came up with a great game plan to one project, but it would actually cross two jurisdictional boundaries. So then you keep coming west, and you start looking at Rita Road. So the Rita Road interchange is on the plan as well. That's at $120 million. That's a great example of where the RTA money is about $20 million, but the regional money or the state money is $100 million. So that's a $120 million improvement for that interchange. Obviously, those folks out there by the IBM and Target super center out there, the distribution center, they understand that. So as we continue to come, we'll go south now over towards Saurita. So we have, you know, the Saurita road interchange that will be at La Cañada, from La Cañada to Rancho Saurita Boulevard. You know, again, a big improvement. Again, another example of great leverage, $15 million investment on our end, $85 million coming from the state. You know, so again, a great investment there, a great opportunity for us. And then you start coming up, we'll call it north. So you have Valencia Road. You have, the Drexel Road. Again, a huge corridor bringing that east-west traffic. And those folks that see that now understand that those cross-sections, if you will, those roadways have different configurations. Some are 2 lanes, some are 4 lanes. And so we're really looking at how we can improve that area. And so, again, through our partners at the City of Tucson and Pima County, really working together to look at that as a corridor as a whole, I think is extremely important. So, we, you know, keep coming west along the freeway. You start looking at some of the interchanges. You've got Cortero Road. You know, Cortero Road's been on the plan now for quite a while in terms of a lot of talk, a lot of conversation, extremely complex interchange because of the amount of commercial development there, proximity to the railroad tracks. But again, a great example, that total cost is about $240 million, but yet our investment locally is about $20 million. So we're really looking at the state to pick up about $220 million of that. That's huge. That's incredible. Then you go further to the west, you got Tangerine Road Interchange. Again, an opportunity to really take advantage of some of what we've already started in RTA 1, not only in the corridor that comes over from Oro Valley. And I think when you look at those types of projects, you realize the importance of the region. So I know, Ed, Ted, you live over in Oro Valley. So when you want to get to the freeway, you're going to probably come down if you want to go to Phoenix. I don't know why you would, but you on occasion might want to go to Phoenix.
I agree with you. Unfortunately, my job does require that a lot. And you're right, Tangerine TI has been a mess. I mean, there's so much growth still going out there. It's just a nightmare backing up. And a lot of times Google will tell you, you need to cut down and go over further south to save time. And we've got to get past that.
And, you know, what really makes me nervous about the Tangerine today is how the traffic backs up. I didn't realize the amount. I had a meeting out there with my buddies at Marana and driving along, and all of a sudden about half mile up, I see red lights, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? Red taillights, and people are actually queuing on the shoulder to get off the freeway. So obviously, I don't need to tell folks about the importance of that.
Tangerine and Marana, it happens at both those TIs.
But to the credit of the Marana folks, you know, Mayor Post and Terry, their manager, really started looking at the we'll call it a holistic approach to improvements out there. And you know, they've got more roads than you interchange. Right now you go by and there's a little green sign that says more road, and that's it. That's it. But that's an extremely important component of the transportation out there. furthers not only the traffic that's you know coming from Oro Valley and from the city of Tucson that what we'll call it uses the interchange at Tangerine, but also how does it affect and help those folks? There's a lot of population growth both along the east and the west side of the I-10 in that area. So again, a huge project and a huge investment.
So we've got one more minute, and I think you've done a great job showing the regionality. You took us from the east all the way to the north, southeast all the way to the northwest. You talked about the state funding, but a lot of that comes from the federal government. It's just what the state transportation board gets where we get our funding to distribute.
That's correct.
So that's really leveraging not just state assets, but it's leveraging the federal assets mm-hmm. and for a difference. RTAmobility.com is where people can go. You're doing multiple outreach programs every day, and I appreciate all the hard work that you've been doing.
Well, I appreciate that. It's really the staff. We've got a great team. What I would encourage folks to think about is as they see these, and they'll be on the website, please engage.
Sounds like a good finish. Michael Ortega, I appreciate all your work and look forward to having you back. Stay with us through the top of the break. We're expecting to be joined by Sadie Shaw. Listening to 1030 The Voice. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping me on time and on target. That's
And caffeinated
caffeinated today. Right? I appreciate that. You are the jack of all trades. There's no doubt. And when I came in and said, wow, that's cold coffee, I was not shooting that at you for the record.
No, no, no.
You know better than that.
It was yesterday coffee. Yeah, yesterday coffee is never. This is the combat coffee. Everybody's just loving it here. Combat coffee. Thank you to Combat Coffee for the great. For the great coffee beans. We love it.
Absolutely. And my intention is to bring him back in December.
Good.
Because we had such a great conversation, not just about his coffee, which is pretty amazing, but also the foundation, oneveteranfoundation.org, which is that he supports and starts. So we'll come back. It was a great conversation. I look forward to having that one. Speaking of great conversations, that talk with
Fantastic.
Michael Ortega.
He sidestepped my question, but that's okay.
Yeah, well.
Well, he didn't. He said he didn't recall. So, I mean, he didn't recall.
He didn't. I know he was aware of the meeting. He just couldn't remember if the closed loop, your closed loop. And we're going to put it back on Joe Ferguson.
That's the question I would like an answer to. Because I've heard that it's, heard Beal put it in their memo saying that that was their original position and that the city pushed for going with using water if they would help them with their recycled water.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about engagement on this show. And obviously I would tell you that the deciding factor in the city's decision on Project Blue, in my Ted's opinion, was the community outreach and the vocal loud voice that got behind this is a bad idea.
Sure.
There's been a lot of criticism to the business entities and business organizations and some of us taking a little, like SALC saying, all right, should we engage on this more? I think there wasn't a ton of engagement because we really believe the concept had already been kind of pressed through everything.
Right.
And then when the population stood up and said no and said it loudly, using techniques that I personally disagreed with the folks using it as well as the city, because the First Amendment rights doesn't give you the right to trample on somebody else's First Amendment rights. If you want to yell at each other and shout people down, you do it outside of a public meeting.
Well, I'm wondering how many of the protesters went to ChatGPT and said, what's a really effective way to protest something?
Well, GPT.
My point means using AI. How many of them are using AI in
the
their
data
daily
centers,
lives, which is most of them.
Absolutely. So I've got to get your feedback on what you thought of Mike Ortega's conversation and the some of the projects. And
well, I mean, just look at
the funding
look at the far
in
RTA ranging.
Next.
Look at the far ranging boundaries of the project. I mean, he was at one point. You guys are talking about the Cortero interchange, which that's like everything else. It needed to be done, probably 10 years ago. The Tangerine interchange, and then you're talking about Vail, basically from Rincon Valley Road and Camino Loma Alta and all that out there. So, I mean, it is far ranging there. I think just this, the geographic footprint of it just demonstrates the need for a regional approach to this. I mean, there's stuff, surface streets, sort of expressways or whatever you want to call it, because we don't do freeways.
We don't
here.
Do freeways in
Ring
in
roads.
Pima County.
I heard that one, 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
The official designation is our arterial, our major arterial roadways.
But yeah, and I mean, you know, the city's trying to fight this battle with the tax that they passed over the over going into neighborhoods and fixing streets. I mean, it's everywhere, and you know, sadly, the region is you know between $1 and $2 billion with deferred maintenance, right? That they've let it go, and now we're constantly playing catch up. But it just goes to show the wide ranging scope and that RTA is involved in. You know, when you're talking stuff from the far southeast part of the metro area to the far northwest part, I mean, it just goes to show the scope of this.
I think we forget how large Pima County is. I mean, and it goes way out to the west.
Well, the city of Tucson out to the southwest. I mean, it is just a huge, massive footprint.
And that's one of the criticisms I'll hear every once in a while about RTA Next is that there's nothing in my region or there's nothing in my area. And I understand those concerns. That's why I was appreciative that Mike kind of displayed the all the way from the east all southeast all the way to the northwest, because there is something for everybody in there. The challenge is there enough money to do everything we need to make this region truly efficient and effective? No, probably not. And the big concern is if the fallback is to have the county do it, very difficult, or to have the individual municipalities to do it, there's definitely not enough money to get everything done that we need to get done at this time. So I was grateful to hear that conversation. It's going to be a conversation. Obviously, the election's not till March. There's a lot more going on. PAG, RTA are going to continue to try to educate folks on what's going on and what's out there. But it's educate. You'll eventually see campaigns, probably for and against, started at some point after the city elections are over, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah. You know, I heard Councilman Cunningham on the Buckmaster show about a week ago, and it was really interesting. He was talking about the dilemma that the region finds itself in because so many, you know, there's so much unincorporated land and the state shared revenue and all or the revenue formulas from the state to the regions are that if you're not incorporated, you get less. Right, the incorporated areas get more. So I found it very interesting that the city of Tucson, who has fought every incorporation effort possible, you know, is whining that we don't get money here because we don't have enough incorporated areas. It just kills me. So you know, you talk about the layers and depths of the financial issues down here, and you know, everybody has played a role in this. The no growthers have played a role in blocking freeways. The city has played a role in blocking annexations that would have brought, you know, apples to apples, more dollars per person into the region.
And it's significant. You know, Chuck Huckleberry used to always say, well, let's not oversell it. You know, which people would say it's going to be $100 million or $80 million to the region that would come in if we were to be able to annex the 36% of our county that is unincorporated.
Yeah.
3% of Maricopa is unincorporated.
Is that right?
3%.
3%.
And we've got 36%. And it absolutely impacts the shared state revenue. Kind of interesting, though, it's already becoming an issue for some elections in some of the municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up at the candidates that are running and starting to run, I mean, again, I think our election system's gotten way too long. We've got candidates announcing in Oro Valley already who's running.
Mm.
Some famous names that people might remember around here, Christy Simone, mm-hmm, being one, is running in Oro Valley. But what you're...
Mark Napier
is running. And you're hearing a lot of discussion about Oro Valley or these candidates that are running wanting to start look at annexation.
Mm-hmm.
Because Oro Valley's time and time again kind of voted against growth.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
How do you increase your municipalities' revenues? Annex.
So, and this is the other thing. So I talk about the different layers of things that have added up to where we are at. So one annexation that the city of Tucson did not, I don't think, you would know, but you correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the city of Tucson tried to block the Vail annexation. They did that to themselves, right?
They
blocked their own annexation.
That's
another thing. It would have brought more money into the region.
Matt, that is a great point. That is a great point, because the first effort by Vail. Yeah. I would say the county kind of block.
Okay.
Administrator Huckleberry at the time wasn't a big fan of it. Uh-huh. There was a lot of talk about, okay, most areas like Vail that are going to look at incorporating, when they do that, they have to enter an agreement with somebody to provide their police and fire until either they can establish their own. Well, they have rural fire out there. That was covered, the rural metro and the folks out there in that area. But the police would have been the sheriffs. Well, the numbers people were being told, or the numbers that the opponents were using, were it's going to be such a huge number that you couldn't do it. And they're fearful of, oh, if we do this, we're going to get taxed. We're going to get additional property tax. We may get a sales tax. You know, I don't want that. I don't want more growth in my region. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they vote no.
Mm-hmm.
The second time through, I think they rushed it back to trying to get it along, and they missed some things. There were some things with the campaign that maybe could have been done better. But the fact of the matter is, they voted no again. Once a community's voted no on something once, you know, 10 years later, it doesn't mean they're ready to do it unless it's been proven to them that they absolutely have to have this, or we're not, you know, our life's not good. I'm telling you, I think most of the people that live in the Vail area, they like it.
Yeah.
Now, you're not going to see a ton of economic growth. You're not going to see all that.
Well, of course, because the city went and annexed the biggest money-making potential property in the whole area of Vail and took that off the table and said, okay, well, if you guys are going to waive off incorporation, we're going to take that money and we're going to make a pile, or we're going to take that land and we're going to make a pile of money on it.
And if the city's smart, they will do so.
They did, and they will.
And that's, you need to incorporate it. But the problem is you have to incorporate houses too, because the shared state revenues comes from the citizenry.
Ah.
It doesn't come, you don't get this much for having a business.
State shared revenue is sales tax receipts, or what am I missing?
It is through the sales tax. I think it's even income. There's several different funds, I believe, that play into it.
Okay.
I don't know enough to be, but all I know is it's based on number of incorporated citizens in the towns.
Interesting.
So you can annex all the land, but if you don't annex any of the households, it doesn't do you any good. And that's one of the issues that they had in Oro Valley. You know, they annexed Westward Look.
Yeah.
But it was like right down the street lines, did not annex any of the homes.
Interesting.
And if you want the goods and services, you need
them. Westward Look is technically
Oro Valley.
Not technically, it is.
It's Oro Valley. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, something new from the Morning Voice.
Wow.
So we'll see. We're going to take a break right now. We're hoping to hear from Sadie Shaw. We do have a backup plan, and it won't necessarily just be more of Ted and Matt talking, but, you know, I enjoy these conversations when we get the opportunity.
As it is, and or confusing on my part, but again, you annex. I want to annex where I live. I don't care if it's just my street, because I want to walk up and down the street. Well, let's make a city called Mattville.
Mattville.
And I'll say, sign this petition, and if it goes through, your water rates go down 20%. How about that?
Well, and that's true, because that is one of the city of Tucson's agreements, at least according to Councilmember Cunningham. If you annex or incorporate, your water rates will lower. You will not be paying the differential rate. So there's so much more to that one. At some point, maybe we'll bring somebody in that can really talk about it. But Oro Valley candidates are starting to talk about coming down to Orange Grove, maybe moving to sweeping across the Catalina foothills. See if you can get some of those folks in, because
an access with Marana.
If you drive up into even the Catalina foothills right now, you can find a lot of roads that need help.
Yeah.
There's just not money for it. Well, there's our gripe for the morning. Stay with us. You're listening to 10:30 The Voice. Bustos Media provides this trusted local news and talk station. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's keeping us on time and on target as usual. That's a lot of accidents going on out there. There's a lot of backups. If you're on the road today, please slow down. Take your time. Being slow sometime can be more efficient. And most importantly, you get there safely. So we'll do that. So I'm pleased to welcome Sadie Shaw to the show this morning. Sadie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ted.
Today's been a great day for bringing on folks who I would tell you are involved in their community. The whole purpose of our engagement hours is to try to get and encourage you to find a way to make a difference in your community. And Sadie Shaw is a mother, an artist, an arts administrator, a neighborhood organizer, an oral historian. In 2020, she was elected to Tucson Unified School District Board, but prior to that, she served in all sorts of different capacities, including with the League of Women Voters of Greater Tucson. She's been the president of her Sugar Hill Neighborhood Association. I could go on and on. Sadie, just enough to say is thank you for stepping in and getting engaged in your communities. And I really appreciate you taking some time with us today.
Thanks, Ted.
So all of that, those other roles you take, eventually led you decide to run for public office. What in your upbringing, in your background, made you decide that that's something you wanted to do?
Well, I saw a need. You know, I didn't enroll my daughter in Tucson Unified thinking that I was going to be engaged so much in her education. But over the first couple years, when I put her in the district, I saw some things that I did not expect growing up and graduating from the amphitheater school district. We always had art and music and PE at every school that I attended. And so I thought that would be a given when I enrolled her in TUSD. And unfortunately, I found out that not every school had those opportunities. So that's really why I decided to run for office in 2020, because, you know, no matter what I did, meeting with her first school's administration and even going higher up into the fine arts director, there was just no way that I was going to get art and music at her school. So luckily, we accomplished that in my first year on the governing board.
And that's a big change. Growing up in the 70s through elementary school and middle school and high school, those were standard fare. So was civics. There were so many more things. It was, a more diverse academic environment. And we got focused on STEM, which I understand was important, but we forgot the role of those other things. What was the process like that you had to go through to get that problem fixed?
Well, luckily, we were blessed with the COVID relief funds that made it possible to expand the arts in TUSD. But of course, those funds did run out, and then we had to find it in our regular budget. So we did do that. Still, you know, there are those strong arts schools and other TUSD schools still have the arts, but they might not necessarily have such a robust program as some of our star art schools like Davis or Tucson High. So, you know, with public education, the funding is so, you just can't depend on it each year. And so with this override, I hope that we can continue to expand the arts in Tucson Unified.
So thank you for bringing up the override. One of the things that will be on the ballot for the residents of TUSD this November, so you've got the ballots already in your mailbox. They might be somewhere in your house still. As you know, we speak very highly that it's your basic responsibility to vote and be an educated voter. So can you tell everybody a little bit about what Prop 414 and the override will bring to TUSD?
Of course. So the override is, you know, we haven't had an override in TUSD in a very long time. It's something that, like, all school districts in Pima County typically have an override going right now. I believe we're the only one that doesn't. And so with this override, we hope to increase teacher pay. Like I said, we're going to expand the arts and also get a PE at every school in TUSD. We have it at a lot of them, but there's some elementary schools that just don't have it yet, and there's just no way to fund it at this moment in time. One of the other things I'm really excited about is that we're going to bring back the certified librarian position to our schools. That's something that a previous board had to do away with because of funding constraints. And so, you know, having a certified librarian in each school is so critical to literacy and teaching students how to properly research things. Other than that, we're going to be able to bring down the ratios for counselors. Right now, we're at like 1 to 500 students for counselors. We're going to bring that ratio down to one counselor per 400 students. That's going to be critical for our students. And then we're going to be able to also fund some of our CTE programs, bringing more teachers to each school so that every student has the opportunity to have a robust career and technical education program at their school.
Well, Sadie, you are absolutely correct. TUSD is the only major school district in this region that does not have an override. All of the others have overrides, and some also have bonds, and TUSD really hasn't gone, I'd say, back to that well for a while. That's so one of the reasons I think you're seeing some organizations that are getting behind and supporting this. You talked about all the shortfalls that funding makes an impact on. I guess the one criticism people will say is that there's been a declining enrollment in TUSD, in part because of the ESAs, also in part because of the ability for inter-district transfers. Do you believe that at some point the board needs to address either closing some of the facilities or getting them to the point where the attendance is more near capacity versus being sometimes, in some cases, you know, 50% or less?
Absolutely. You know, it's not fiscally responsible for us to continue on with the way things are going. We do have some schools in TUSD that have painfully low enrollments, and, you know, that does put a strain on our budget. And so we're looking for creative ways to address this issue without, you know, jumping the gun and saying that we're going to close schools down like we see in the FI school district. If you watched our last board meeting, we voted on these superintendent's goals for this upcoming year. And I really pushed the board to have one of our superintendent's goals to be to increase enrollment by 3%. Most people would think that that would already be a goal of our superintendent, but over the last couple of years, the board eliminated that goal and had it just be like flat line, knowing that enrollment is declining enrollment is something that each school district is grappling with. But, you know, I pushed back on that, and luckily the board members, the majority of them voted yes on that. As you know, the only employee that is under the board is the superintendent, so we do have the power to direct him to find a way to increase our enrollment because, you know, of course there's declining birth rates, but there's also ESAs and charter schools and other school districts that are siphoning our TUSD families. So we just need to be more persuasive and promote ourselves more because we do have some amazing programs in TUSD. We just got to bring those families back.
We've got about 40 seconds. So I appreciate that you're at on the percentage of growth of increase for students. Do you see maybe next year putting a goal on there as well as about to address some of those closing school issues?
Not quite sure yet if we're going to do that next year. We're really trying to do everything we can before that to prevent school closures in TUSD.
No, fully understand that. Nobody wants their local neighborhood school to close. But like you said, there's the fiscal responsibility side. I appreciate you staying with us for one more segment. We're interested in talking with you about your run for Ward 3. Thank you, Sadie. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. Now, there's a song that will wake you up if you're not bright-eyed yet.
If you're up late watching baseball, yeah, you know, last night, like some of us may or may not have been.
Just some of us are not. I want to jump right back into the interview with Sadie Shaw, school board member for the Tucson Unified School District. Sadie, again, I appreciate you joining us. I think your dedication to this community and your involvement is exemplary.
Thank you.
So you took it a step further last year. You decided that you wanted to jump in and now try to make a difference at the city council and provide a new face, a new voice, and a difference. And you ran for city council for Ward 3 against the incumbent Kevin Dahl. Can you talk to us a little bit about why you decided to do that and more so about the experience that you had doing that?
Of course. So I wasn't planning to run for city council this year, but, you know, seeing that there was no challenger to the incumbent, Mr. Kevin Dahl, and just thinking about Ward 3, how it is now, what my neighborhood is dealing with and thinking about, you know, the future, what's going to happen in the next 4 years. I decided to, you know, throw my name in the hat and try to really be a strong advocate for Ward 3 and Ward 3 issues. You know, if you drive around Ward 3, you can definitely see that there are a lot of disparities compared to the other parts of town. Ward 3, we have the highest poverty rate in the city of Tucson. And you could see it. It's visible when you drive down our streets. I'm thinking Stone, you know, Oracle, Limberlost. Like, if you know, you know. And so, unfortunately, when we see improvements in the city of Tucson, they always seem to happen in the areas where they're not necessarily needed most. Given my experience on the TUSD governing board, being the strong advocate for students, parents, and staff, and really pushing that the resources that we do have are used equitably in the smartest way, I felt that, you know, I could do the same thing for the city of Tucson. I know my neighbors really appreciated my run, appreciated me raising the issues that we've all been dealing with over the years. And we got close, and I learned so much about the city of Tucson, about the needs of our Ward 3 residents. And, you know, I hope that during my run in the primary, I elevated the conversation and really pushed our incumbent and the other mayor and council members to really consider what's happening in the areas of Tucson that are often forgotten.
Well, I think you make a great point. As you said, if you know, you know. Ward 3 does have some areas that I also believe we could use some investment. I know you're still the vice president of the Sugar Hill Neighborhood Association. You care about that. What, 19 votes. I mean, 19 votes. Yeah. I've not heard of many that have gotten closer, went to a recall. It still was 19 votes. But there were some issues also with the ballots and how they went out. And what was your takeaway from it? Do you feel at this point right now that everything was resolved, or do you see things, changes that need to be made in either the election system or how they're monitored in the primaries?
Yeah, I definitely think there can be some improvements. You know, the county and the city worked together for the primary election and even the general. And so there's just some miscommunication that can happen. Like, you know, the city of Tucson has to send the voter information, and then the county prints it. So there's just a lot of opportunity for mistakes. And there was a mistake in our primary where people who recently registered to vote didn't receive a ballot. There was upwards of 300 in my ward and hundreds of others in the other wards that were within the primary. And, you know, we found out through the research during our lawsuit that the problem was greater than we had anticipated. Unfortunately, a lot of the voter information that we found couldn't be presented at the courthouse because it wasn't in our original filing. But, you know, things happen, and, you know, there's a lot of stipulations when you do file a lawsuit, especially in elections one. And so we learned a lot, and I think the voters are happy that we raised the issue. And I just hope that errors in our elections don't happen again.
Well, there's nothing more sacred, and we talk about it on this show all the time, that the voting is our most sacred right. And we also tell the voters, you have to be responsible. So hearing that some voters may have been disenfranchised just doesn't help the system.
Well, especially in a 19-vote difference outcome.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, so what kind of feedback have you received from your supporters and maybe from some of those who weren't your supporters but felt like it may not have been, I don't want to say just, because they counted again 19 votes, but you didn't get the full, conscious of the actual voters the way it turned out.
Yeah, from what I've heard, people are grateful that I raised the issue. I mean, like you said, the integrity of our elections are really critical. And every time there is an issue, it just tips away at people's trust. And so, by and large, people have appreciated what I've done. You know, there's, of course, people who think it was a waste of time or a waste of money. But for those voters who just didn't receive a ballot, which is statutorily required that every voter who's registered should receive a ballot, I know that they appreciated it. So.
Sadie, this is Matt. I'd like to ask just one question. There's been discussion, you know, the Star Village concept that I guess is now open. There's been a lot of conversation. Some of the folks in the Sugar Hill neighborhood said that the neighborhood was not really consulted beforehand. I know, you know, in the intro, Ted said to you work very much with your neighborhood. What's your perspective on the city's working with the neighborhood on the Star Village concept? Do you think that you do you feel that your neighborhood was given adequate notice and a chance to opine and kind of have a say in the matter?
Oh, absolutely not. And you could read more about my opinion on that in the op-ed I wrote for the Arizona Daily Star. But yeah, I received a email from Mr. Kevin Dahl the day after the primary election notifying us that it was going to be discussed in executive session. And that was basically it. He gave us, you know, the rundown, 25 women or non-binary folks will be camping in our neighborhood, just down the street from our park, Dorsey Thompson Park. And that was basically it. We had a neighborhood association meeting a couple weeks later. The Ward 3 staff member did not have any other information for us. In fact, every consecutive meeting after that, we were given no information, including the one we had this month. And so there's definitely a disconnect in, you know, getting the neighbors on board first. I understand that this is a pilot project, and so they're just going to see how it goes for the next year. But I think that they really missed an opportunity in giving the neighbors an ability to, you know, at least share their two cents and potentially, you know, help volunteer or all of that. We did have a neighborhood wide opportunity to hear from the city and those stakeholders who are working at Star Village, but it wasn't a back and forth at all. It was, you know, the city talking to us about their plans. We weren't able to give them ideas or raise concerns. Still, there hasn't been any effort to offer Sugar Hill any protections from law enforcement if there is an uptick in crime in our neighborhood. And really, they just leave it on us to reach out to the organizers of Star Village to get more information. We were given an email address, but that's basically what's happened. So it's unfortunate. I hope Star Village is a success, but the way they rolled it out is, you know, kind of, I guess, pissing off all the surrounding neighborhoods. So
one quick follow-up question. I know it's only been open for a very short time. Are there any notable observations that you or any of your neighbors have so far?
You know, I haven't noticed much yet. I'm not sure if they're at capacity. You know, Sugar Hill has always had a little bit of a crime problem, especially nearby that park. We have had, unfortunately, you know, assaults and murders happen in that area this year. And, you know, it's just it's a problem in the Thrive in the 05 area, not just in Sugar Hill, but all around this area of Ward 3. And so, you know, I don't think crime is going to be reduced from Star Village. It may increase, who knows, but I'm waiting to see the data on that.
Well, Sadie, I really appreciate you being honest in that. Matter of fact, if you get into your, if anybody gets on and reads your op-ed, it was hard-hitting, it was truthful, it was upfront. That's something I've always respected about you, is you are going to say what's on your mind and what you believe. And I'm sure this is not the end. You're still a member of the Tucson Unified School Board. I've got a sense there may even be more in Sadie Shaw's future. So I greatly appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much, Ted. And yeah, you know, I encourage everyone listening to get involved in your community. Like, you know, if we all got involved and joined our neighborhood association or started an organization ourselves, we can help guide the leaders of Tucson and Pima County to make Tucson a better place. And I think that's what we all want. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all. And yeah, I hope to see you and talk to you again soon.
I'm sure we'll do that. I'd love to have you back on. Have a great day today. And you said it perfectly. If you want to make a difference and you're listening, get involved, get engaged. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. And that was Sadie Shaw, the voice of Sadie Shaw, candidate for Ward 3 and a current member of the Tucson Unified School District. Great interview, and I appreciate her time. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glass. We probably needed all that energetic music early in the show, Matt. It would have been great.
Indeed, sir.
So for this last segment, was it going to be Matt and Ted? Nope, it's going to be Matt, Ted. Josh Jacobson's joined us in the studio, and he's here a little early. He's going to be on Wind Tucson, so make sure you stay around to listen to Josh and Kathleen talk about local issues that are going on. So, Josh, welcome here this morning.
Thank you. I'm always happy to be on your show, and then I get to jump on to another show where I can share my perspective from a woman's perspective. That's Kathleen.
Breaking news.
Sorry. Yeah,
breaking news going on now.
You heard it here first.
Josh, is there anything else you want to tell us about?
Well, I just got 50% more popular in Tucson.
You did. You're it's going up. Lucky wishbone. Look out! You're going to get a flood of people coming to you now. It's going to be incredible. So we've got one of our listeners who was listening to the show, and he reached out and said, hey, I'd love to call in. So I'd like to welcome Jay Tolkoff.
Not only a listener,
Jay Tolkoff.
The front runner for Ward 6.
A candidate for Ward 6 in the city of Tucson. Good morning, Jay. How you doing?
Doing fantastic. Sounds like I'm joining a pretty good party there.
Well, it's definitely, you know, anytime Josh Jacobson shows up, it just becomes a party. He kind of brings it with him. So Jay,
he is a fun guy.
Absolutely. So Jay, we got about 6 minutes left. If Matt can extend us a minute, which he's looking to see if he can do. How's the campaign going? There's a sense that there could be some potential there. I know the ballots are coming in still about 2-1, but much more higher turnout on the Republican side than most people would expect. From your perspective, how are things going, and what are some of the words you want to get out to your potential voters, other than to vote? Again, everybody, if you've got a ballot, vote.
Yeah, that is always the big thing. I'm actually sitting here looking at the ballot returns as of last night, and what's really scary is the total turnout for the city so far is only 17.86%. The Democrats are turning about 23%, and the Republicans are lagging at 21%. So, you know, we'd like to see more people, rather than complaining about their city, actually doing something about it, and filling out first step would be to fill out a ballot. Myself, I was actually out campaigning at 4 o'clock in the morning with a bunch of Teamster Union people, talking to their different people that they represent that are up early, you know, making your deliveries of food and beer and all other kinds of things. And we did that yesterday, and we're going to be doing it tomorrow and Thursday also.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's really important for the listeners to understand that you are endorsed by the Teamsters 104. That's the organized labor arm of the Suncheon Bus Drivers Union. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's huge for them to endorse a Republican when traditionally they have not.
Well, that they actually, one of the guys today brought that up while we were, waiting for the sun to rise out in front of a building. Bottom line is that my opponent and the city can talk about how they're all pro-union, but I mean, if you ever ride the buses and see what our union bus drivers have to put up with because of the policies that are in place right now, to me, it's unconscionable. As a former employer, I would never ask an employee to work under the conditions that they they are currently working in, and that the Teamsters and the bus drivers would speak out regularly at mayor and council meetings during the call of the audience, saying, you know, this has got to stop. And it didn't fell on deaf ears until the Teamsters finally had a press conference where they endorsed me, because not only was I a Teamster when I was younger, you know, this just isn't right. And we need to fix that. And it finally took that big press conference and an actual shooting on the bus for the city to finally say, well, maybe we should do something about it. And I just think it's unfortunate that the pro-union people that, you know, are in office, or supposed pro-union people, just ignored what they were talking about for a year.
And Jay, you're absolutely right. We're running short on time, but I want you also to talk about your position on the middle housing, the zoning that's going on. I'm hearing from a lot of Midtown Democrats that they're very concerned, and that's been something that you've been attending the meetings, you've been speaking to folks about. What are you seeing that's concerning on the ground with the middle housing?
Well, to try to put it in a nutshell, I've done a lot of research about different jurisdictions where they've done it. And there's one thing for sure. If you just open it up to wildcat building with really no constraints, bad things happen. Gentrification, displacement, the
reduction of property values.
I'm sorry?
Reduction of property values.
Yeah, the reduction in the nicer neighborhoods, and usually there's an elevation in the poorer neighborhoods because there's a lot of blading going on, and then people that have lived there for generations can't afford the new values of their properties, and they're displaced. But the bottom line is every place that has worked successfully, there are always guidelines that went along with this rezoning, and we're not doing that. And the worst thing is that instead of doing it on a minimal level and see how it works, we're trying to push it across a huge level. I was actually talking to a friend that had a neighborhood association meeting last night where the city was out, not asking for input, but really selling the idea about how the city has decided this is going to be. You know, we do not currently have a voice on going to our government. They pretty much decide what's going to be, and then they go out and do the research to support what they already believe. And a lot of us are just ignored.
Well, Jay, we appreciate you calling in. You know, for some people, you're not Republican enough. For some people, you're not Democrat enough. The fact of the matter is you will be a voice of diversity of thought on that board. So I appreciate you running for that office.
Oh, thank you, Ted.
Tolkoff for Tucson.
There it is.
.com.
You're listening to 1030 The Voice. This has been The Morning Voice. Stay here for Grant Kruger tomorrow for Food for Thought, and stay with us right now to go for Win Tucson to listen to that voice of Josh Jacobson for another segment. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.